It's a health intervention, and a vital one at that. For a mission-led government, it will open up the door to improve child health, preventing illness, boosting business, and strengthening communities. A government spokesperson claimed this government is committed to tackling child poverty, which is why the new ministerial task force launched recently will look at all the available levers across the government as we begin this urgent work. We will also provide access to specialist mental health professionals in every school so young people can get the support and care that they deserve. The website of the Institute for Fiscal Studies has also covered the same story. Research has found local child poverty rates across the United Kingdom correlate very strongly with the percentage of families affected by the two-child benefit cap, indicating that the controversial policy is a key factor behind children growing up in deprivation. The study carried out by Loughborough University for the End Child Poverty Coalition will heap pressure on Labour Party over the party's refusal to abolish the cap, which limits universal credit and child tax credit to a family's first two children if they come into power. The limit can cost families more than £3,000 a year for each additional child, with earlier research showing scrapping the policy would take 300,000 children out of the poverty around the country. The new study was based on existing government statistics for children living in low-income families, defined as those with incomes below 60% of the local median income, but adjusted these for housing costs to avoid underestimating poverty rates in places such as London. It found that in two-thirds of UK parliamentary constituencies, at least a quarter of children were growing up in poverty, with a figure rising to 90% of constituencies in North East and North West of England and in Wales. The coalition, which groups together more than 80 charities, faith groups and unions, said local statistics were useful given the extremely high variation in poverty levels in some places. For example, the study found that Bethnal Green and Stepney in East London had a child poverty rate 19 percentage points higher than the regional average, whilst in Richmond Park, in the west of London, it was 21 percentage points lower. The research compared local child poverty levels with statistics for the proportion of families affected by the two-child cap, finding a very strong correlation between the two and providing further evidence that the policy is a key driver of child poverty. The study cited earlier research indicating the removing the cap at a cost of £1.8 billion annually would take 300,000 children out of poverty and reduce its impact on a further 800,000 children.
Born in Damascus. I am Leila Saab. Born in Damascus in 1970. I was born in Damascus, but not in the prosperous part of Damascus. Our house was located almost on one of the highest points of Mount Qasiyun, and because of this, we used to look at Damascus from above. My mother was a simple village woman, but at the same time, she had a high level of knowledge. And I remember her presence in our lives, especially in our early childhood, was very noticeable because we were born in an era when the Syrian army was always on standby, and my father, who was a military person, was always away from home for long periods of time.
El
The house where I grew up in, it is true that it was the house of an average family. That is, it belonged to the middle class. But they cared about science, culture and study because my father was a person who was interested in science and was eager to learn. And I remember that he always spent a large part of his income on the library. I often accompanied him to libraries, and he always bought daily newspapers, books and storybooks for me. Although his income was small, he spent a significant amount of his income on the library. I recall when I was in high school, I started to pick up a pen to write something creative. Let me put it this way, that at first it started out of habit, but later these texts became valuable. And so at the end of high school, I sometimes held poetry recitals with my father and also with my teachers, my Arabic language teachers, and I remember that every night a poetry recital was held. I was also one of the participating students. And I remember the first time I started writing, I wrote about Palestine. And it developed in me naturally because I listened to my father's conversations with a generation of intellectuals who were still suffering from the pain of the occupation of Al-Quds and discussed such issues, and maybe that made me search more. I recall when Sana'a Mehaidal blew herself up in front of the Zionists' checkpoint as the first Lebanese martyr. She became a very important role model for us, youths and young girls. Of course, the question arose when this happened in Syria too, and that was when Hamida al-Taher carried out one of these operations in the south. And this pushed us towards the direction of being able to plant this thought in our minds, and I clearly felt that the path was clear for me at this stage. That is, this path was such that resistance was evolving for me. The evolution of this jihad, holy war for freedom. And without telling my family, and this was perhaps one of the smallest things that I hid from them at the time, I signed up for martyrdom operations, and I always dreamed of the day when they would call me and say that we accepted you. And high school for me was the time that the idea of resistance began to grow. The idea that a person should defend his or her land.
نهاية المرحلة الثانوية بعد البكالوريا حدثت يعني انعطاف كبير خلينا نقول في.
In the last year of high school, after the 12th grade, a complete change happened in my life. I got married, and this marriage made me move from the city to a different environment, which was a village, a remote village. I was a school student in the city, and when I entered this environment, I was a woman, and they expected me to perform social duties, to participate in celebrations and mourning ceremonies, to run a family and to prove myself in all these daily family details. Be it in cooking, in housework, my duties towards my husband and my husband's family, etc. Here I faced obstacles that were considered unacceptable in this society. That is, it was difficult for this society to accept a married woman to go to university. I mean, with all the hardships I endured, naturally, the decision to have a child shouldn't be postponed. That is, this rural environment couldn't tolerate a woman having kids later in order to finish her education.
Thank you.
It is true that I was the first married woman who graduated from the university, but later it changed, and many women and girls get married and continue their studies simultaneously. And they say that so-and-so was able to continue her studies despite all the difficulties. In this small village, I saw the presence of women in different places. That is, women do not only work at home, but also do agricultural work and even farming and have many duties. I don't know, in a moment I felt that there are things that I can provide services with. There was an association for women's union. This women's union was one of the organizations that existed in all villages, but they weren't active. And I found an opportunity in this organization to try and do something. The first activity we did, the first thing I tried to do was holding literacy classes. On the first day of class, when the ladies came to class, they hid their books under their clothes. That is, she had hidden the book under her clothes so that people wouldn't know that she had come to study. They even said that she's holding a book at this stage. And later, I tried to boost their willpower that there is no shame in doing this. And there was also this matter that we expand our relations with the society. For example, hold nursing classes and teach women skills and trades. I myself learned some things from my mother and also from my mother-in-law, and I held small classes for them and taught them what I knew. We didn't always have a place to hold classes, and with my good relationship with the school, it was possible for me to open the school and hold classes for them in the school. When we had no place, we would either put tables and chairs on the sidewalk next to the school and sit there, or we would have classes at one of our houses, or at one of the students' houses, or at my own house. And the lack of space was never an obstacle for us. We also sometimes invited lawyers from the village or outside the village to explain some issues of inheritance, child education, marriage, etc. It seemed that these cultural activities and these fatigues of working with women, especially in the cultural field, drew the attention of others to the fact that there is a need to establish a cultural place. In this small office, I was obliged to be the head of the cultural center in this village. Of course, here I found the courage not to work only with women. I can also work with children here. I can work with families in general, and we even started working with men. We started cultural activities, reading poetry and holding various celebrations. We trained the children. We started to do something in order to plant the idea of volunteering in people's minds and its importance. In 2010, we focused on environmental and cultural activities. We did an important job in this village, which made the mayor of rural Damascus organize the environmental festival in this village, which is on the first or second day of October, Tishrin al-Awwal. It means everyone left rural Damascus governorate and hold this celebration in this small village. Of course, what they saw was the fruit of our work with children and families, from holding handicraft and recycling exhibitions to art, music, and theater festivals that were held to promote the environmental law issued at the time. We named the first festival Qal'at al-Jandal. When I said the first, we knew that there would be a second and third time. But unfortunately, this phase coincided with the start of the war in Syria.
Here it is.
The war created a change in the course of this festival. We had no weapons. The army was doing its duty. Politicians and diplomats also did their job. Our weapon was culture. Our weapon was words. Our weapon was the thought that you could plant in people's minds. Since the festival started from this small village, the cultural festival of Qal'at al-Jandal was held for 5 years until 2015, and it was modified in terms of content and idea to serve the defense of the homeland, honor the martyrs, honor the families of the martyrs, and appreciate the value of martyrdom. And it was also the bearer of the case of resistance on the foundations of culture, whether through poetry or speeches, to show people the horizon to distinguish between right and wrong, taking into account that some people had doubts.
The
festival continued until 2015, achieved many successes, and little by little its fame was heard not only in rural Damascus Governorate, but in the whole of Syria. When the war started, the brutalities of war and violence became visible. The crisis intensified. At that time, I was offered a promotion at the peak of the war, and this causes you to be transferred, a dangerous transfer. It means that your workplace, which is close to your home, will be transferred to a far place, and it was very difficult for me to prefer my comfort to my duties towards my country. To be honest, I accepted. I accepted the position of managing the cultural center of rural Damascus Governorate, and here we did a very important job, which was related to setting up of voluntary groups. And we set it up in all cultural centers. We set up youth groups from volunteers in the fields of music and literature and tried to attract them, to organize their work and make them part of the new staff. Since this period, a series of important activities were discovered. Generally speaking, a series of festivals, associations, and various theater performances were held.
من هاي المهرجانات طبعاً والفعاليات الكثيرة جداً اللي أقيمت على مدار.
These festivals and activities that were held in rural Damascus during these 3 years, to be honest, the first day that some areas were liberated on, I was in those areas on the second day and tried to build a new cultural center. But some activities had strategic importance. Politics, culture, and even military work overlapped each other. For example, the Yabrut Festival. The Yabrut district was under the control of the opposition for almost 9 months. The liberation of Yabrut was a great victory. Yabrut district is located in an important strategic point. The connection between the opponents was caught with this victory. From Palmyra and even from Homs to Jaiprud Ghalamun to the Zabadani district, and that is why it was a very important victory. This military victory should be completed with a cultural victory. That is why the Yabrut Cultural Festival was held, which included music, national anthem and sing-along, as well as painting exhibitions and support workshops for children who witnessed the war, and it contained very important things that were made in Yabrud. We invited the artisans and experts to organize an exhibition about the industries and factories whose headquarters are located in Yabrud, as people's lives return to their normal routine. One of the valuable things in my heart is a valuable memory of this festival, and that was Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah gave his speech almost a few weeks after the festival and said that life has returned to normal in the areas liberated by the Syrian army and the axis of resistance, and cultural and tourist festivals are held there. And at that moment, I felt that he's talking about me. I felt all my fatigue, all my hardships, all my fears of places where there might be mines, there might be opponents there. I felt that these fears disappeared at that moment when I realized that the commander of the resistance is following up. I felt this great achievement.
يعني سيد المقاومة هو 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 متابع فشعرت بهذا الإنجاز الكبير.
Six months after receiving the position of managing the cultural center of the rural Damascus, we started preparing for the Resistance and Culture Association to somehow connect resistance and culture. In my opinion, the difference of this association is that, first off, it is connecting bridge between the supporters of the resistance, the case of resistance, and the Syrians who are involved in the anti-terrorist war outside the country, whether in Arab or other regional countries. The guests of the Resistance Association in these 3 years included all the neighboring countries. In the third year, the communication between me and the brothers in Iran began. We met on different occasions. In the last forum, there was an exhibition about the heroic deeds of the Syrian army, which was recorded with the cameras of Iranian artists accompanying the army. And there was a painting exhibition and workshops for documentary films, political cartoons, and photography. A few days after the end of the third resistance forum, my removal order from the association was issued. Of course, this decision made me enter a new phase, the warrior's rest phase. This was the name I gave it. I felt sad, sorry, betrayed, and disappointed, but only for a while. What helped me was a large number of my friends in the cultural and intellectual community who started a solidarity campaign with me in the cyberspace. And this stage of despair and betrayal failed to extinguish the flames of resistance inside me.
الحدث الأكبر اللي صار هو صار بخواتيم الحرب. صحيت على خبر.
A big thing happened at the end of the war. I woke up to a news. The certainty I had about resistance increased. When Daesh attacked the eastern suburbs, my village, the alley of my family, my cousins, and all those who are dear to me, when Daesh entered this place, what was the choice of these defenseless people who have less cultural awareness than us? Their choice was not to run away. It was not to surrender. Their choice was to stand and resist and die in front of their house and get martyred. There were families who were all martyred, mothers, fathers, children, and some of them blew up their houses with their families so that they would not be captured by Daesh. After this incident, I become more certain of achieving victory. what sacrifices we made compared to them. We spent some of our time. We moved from one position, maybe from one chair, from one place to another. After I got through this painful stage, I returned to the slogan that I had created myself, which many people took from me. And that was the word sister is an arrow. So I returned to this word and picked up my pen again. And with this pen and through this written word, I can express what I want, and I can serve this great and decisive issue, which in my opinion is the case of resistance.
والقضية المصيرية بالنسبة لي ألا وهي قضية المقاومة. أمنيتي الأهم للثقافة ببلدنا إنها تكون.
And my most important wish is culture for my country to be a strong front, to be a resistant front. Maybe the battles in this period will be military, but I believe that our cultural battle is continuous. I wish from the bottom of my heart that securing the cultural front be of importance. The culture of this country be the first line of defense of this country in future battles. We learn that every time we win, the enemy's tricks increase, and it uses new techniques every time. We must be culturally immune and sensitive to the return of the enemy.
لازم نكون ثقافيا محصنين ومستعدين للمعارك القادمة.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Palestinian prisoners, most of which are held without a charge, are routinely beaten, suffer from medical neglect, repeatedly interrogated without a lawyer present, starved, spat on, verbally abused, and kept in solitary confinement conditions. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, in what Ronen Bar, the head of Israel's Shin Bet Internal Security Services, labeled as an incarceration crisis, Israeli regime prisons and detention centers collectively hold 21,000 Palestinian hostages. These prisoners have been subjected to a range of torture methods, with one of the detention facilities being branded worse than Abu Ghraib. In a move that stirred controversy in the Israeli political establishment, the director of Ashifa Hospital, Dr. Mohammad Abu Salmiya, was released from detention after being held without charges for months. Upon his release, Dr. Salmiya spoke to the media about the horrifying reality facing detainees, noting that prisoners in Israeli jails endure different types of torture. The Zionist regime army treats them as if they were inanimate objects, and Israeli doctors physically assaulted them. He also stated that no international organizations were permitted to visit inmates, nor were they allowed access to lawyers, while the Palestinian prisoners were subjected to severe torture and almost daily assaults inside the prisons and were denied medical treatments. One of the sites where Dr. Salmiya was held is the infamous Sedat Heyman Detention Facility, a military prison center created to detain Palestinians who were kidnapped from Gaza without any charge. According to Palestinian lawyer Khaled Mahajna, who recently gave a first-hand account of the conditions faced in the detention camp after being granted a visit, the treatment is more horrifying than anything we have heard about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Mahajna said that some 4,000 detainees from Gaza Strip, who began calling Sedat Heyman a death camp after at least 35 detainees died under unknown circumstances, were blindfolded and shackled constantly, forced to sleep hunched over the floor. A weekly one-minute shower was the only time the shackles were released, which the inmates started refusing because going over 1 minute resulted in punishment, and they were not given a watch or timer, and going beyond the allotted minute exposes prisoners to severe punishments, including hours outside the heat or rain. Accounts of severe torture, including rape, were also noted. Reports published by CNN, The New York Times, and UNRWA have all attested to severe forms of sexual assault and rape occurring at Sedat Heyman. This included the rape of men, in addition to reports of the use of dogs to intimidate inmates. One man was reported to have been beaten with a metal rod and then left to slowly die from his severe wounds that became infected. Women were also subjected to sexual violence. A 34-year-old woman testified to the UN that a male soldier took off their hijabs. On top of this, there was the implementation of sleep deprivation, starvation, and the use of sounds to torture inmates. While Haaretz newspaper revealed that Palestinian detainees were regularly having their limbs amputated after circulation was cut off due to tying them up too tight. While most of the media attention has been placed upon the Sedat Heyman detention camp, there are at least 21,000 Palestinians being held hostage by the Israeli regime across facilities that are only built to handle 14,500 prisoners. In late November, Palestinian journalist Barah Abu Ramos, who had just been freed in a prisoner exchange, commented on the conditions female prisoners were subjected to, stating that the situation in the prisons is devastating. The prisoners are abused. They are being constantly beaten. They are being sexually assaulted. They are being raped. I'm not exaggerating. The prisoners are being raped. Due to newly imposed measures, since the Israeli security minister Itamar Ben-Gvir was given power over the conditions of prisoners, almost all of the basic rights that international law dictates be available to detainees are being deprived of them. In most cases, this includes the rights to food, clean, water, family visits, bedding, etc. Palestinian prisoners, most of which are being without a charge, are routinely beaten, suffer from medical neglect, repeatedly interrogated without a lawyer present, starved, spat on, verbally abused, and kept in solitary confinement conditions. Torture methods such as stress positions, the use of a chair with smaller legs at the front, which prisoners are bound to, and where they are forced to defecate on themselves, have long been routine and are being weaponized today more than ever. Even before the October 7th, 2023, reports had emerged that prisoners were being used to perform hard labor, tantamount to a form of slavery. Palestinian detainees are being interrogated under conditions of torture and threats to their families' lives. Cases of this occurred against prisoners who were taken captive by the Israeli regime military, who were forced to confess to committing acts they could not possibly have performed on October 7th, which were then paraded around as proof of Hamas acts, despite some of these individuals being proven not to be the Hamas resistance movement's members. It suffices to say that over 21,000 Palestinian hostages are being tortured, starved, and sexually abused on a mass scale in clear violation of international law. This is not even including those who were previously detained by the Israeli regime military inside the Gaza Strip, where a UN report released on June 12th detailed the fact that Israeli regime forces had systematically targeted and subjected Palestinians to violence online and in prison since October 7, including forced public nudity, forced public stripping, sexualized torture and abuse, and sexual humiliation and harassment. In this report, it covers various cases of sexual violence and even rape, yet it specifically focuses on crimes committed against Palestinians during their detention by Israeli regime forces.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. We are focusing on Kenya, where for weeks, Kenyans have been rallying across the country against the government. What began as protests against proposals imposed by the International Monetary Fund on a sharp increase in taxes on essential goods and rampant corruption has now escalated into calls for the president to step down. Is this East African economic powerhouse in peril of descending into anarchy? The second part of our show will be on the 30th anniversary of the April 1994 Rwanda genocide. France continues to face accusations of playing a role in the genocide of nearly 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus. Kenyans reject IMF U.S. meddling. In April 2021, Kenya entered into a $3.6 billion deal with the International Monetary Fund in exchange for savage take hikes under the Finance Bill 2024. This bill was part of a structured debt repayment plan imposed by the lending body that reports directly to the United States. The finance bill was seen as a brutal attack on the working class and rural masses already suffering a soaring cost of living worsened since the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine. Kenyans are well aware that the draconian finance bill was imposed on the government of President William Ruto by the IMF.
Pretty sure the finance bill wasn't proposed by Ruto. It was proposed by the IMF.
The Kenyan masses have vowed to continue their protests until the country disentangles itself from the IMF and US-imposed predatory economic system. President Ruto initially opted to listen to policy advice from the Bretton Woods institutions, and this angered Kenyans, particularly the Generation Z. Experts believe the government now must de-decolonize the Kenyan economy while meeting the aspirations of Kenyans for a developed and democratic country.
If you look at the IMF and the World Bank, these are banking institutions. They look at profit over people. They look at how to maximize money. And so, if you are dealing with them, you should be mindful that the relationship with them is not going to be a win-win situation.
Despite President Ruto's withdrawal from the draconian tax bill, sacking of his entire cabinet, and scrapping of unpopular expenditure, such as funds dedicated for use by the president's and deputy president's spouses, protesters are demanding that he steps down. There's growing concern that unless there is a dialogue, the country risks sliding into anarchy like Sudan after Omar al-Bashir was forced to step down.
Ruto came to power by assuring the downtrodden, assuring the youth, assuring the unemployed. And so all of a sudden, for them to be experiencing what is going on, the resistance will come on. And I think Kenya is a society that I can foresee not going the way of Sudan. They'll be able to manage the situation and will be able to fight it to the extent that what the people want is what exactly they will get without disrupting the sovereign stability. And you must know that what the people are doing in themselves is part of checks and balances on the stewardship of leadership. But if the three arms of governance are not able to check themselves well, the popular uprising of the people will constitute a form of checks to ensure good governance.
Kenya's youth unemployment rate is almost 20%, with over 83% of people working in the informal sector. The protests in Kenya inspired wild optimism because they are led by young, eloquent, educated Kenyans who are not tainted by political or tribal allegiance.
They buy cars, they're just enriching themselves. Meanwhile, many percentage of Kenyans are languishing in poverty still. We have people who do not have access to education, who do not have access to health care.
These unprecedented protests across Kenya are expected to herald far-reaching changes in this East African economic powerhouse.
They are waging the struggle in diversity, in the midst of diversity. They are not looking at it from the tribal background. They are not looking at it from the political background. They are looking at it from how the nation should stand and stand independent, where the sovereignty of the republic will be respected. And so that is a novelty. They are not being torn into groups or divisions. Because if they are being torn into groups or divisions, the enemy will infiltrate and penetrate, because divided they are, they will lose the fight. And so it looks like the Kenyan youth have really defined a path of unity and seen themselves as Kenyans first and foremost. And for that matter, it is their duty to protect the sovereignty of Kenya and move it forward in a way that they will all be happy in a society that they want.
Kenyan protesters are also calling for the ejection of the U.S. ambassador to Kenya, Meg Whiteman, saying she is the one pushing for unpopular policies aimed at further impoverishing the masses. She's a well-known billionaire within U.S. tech giants. Kenya's former Prime Minister Raila Odinga reminded the ambassador that Kenya is no longer a colony of the United States.
Tell the rogue ambassador, Kenya is not United States. Kenya is not a colony of the United States. Keep your mouth shut when you hear. Otherwise, we will call for your recall back to your country.
Make White Man and the IMF are seen by many as the greatest threat to Kenya's sovereignty as a nation. Billionaire White Man is said to have accepted her appointment as the U.S. ambassador to Kenya at behest of exploitative U.S. multinationals. Irate Kenyans say her presence in Nairobi is endangering the country's sovereignty.
You know very well that the IMF and the World Bank have owners. And when they have owners, the owners are being sent outside to fight for the interests of the imperial powers. And I don't think the youth will be demanding or calling for this in a vacuum. There should be a reason. Recently, Ruto was welcomed in the White House. Recently, Ruto was convinced to send policemen to Haiti. And this has raised a lot of questions within Africa. And where is it all coming from? The source of all these things. And we all know, it's no more secret, that state embassies are a source of information to powers that be. And if they have examined and they know that the ambassador is one of the problems of Kenya and they want her to leave, it rests on the demand of the people.
Africa's protest movements are growing in the world's youngest continent, where 70% of the population are under the age of 30. Young people across Africa have looked at the mass protests in Kenya as an inspiration because IMF provides loans to desperate African governments on brutal terms that impact negatively on the poor. Africa is the youngest continent where 70% of the population are under the age of 30. The protests by young Kenyans are expected to spread to other countries.
The IMF has never helped any country in Africa to succeed. I'm yet to see one or told. We all know that all these measures affect the youth who graduates from the university, they finish with their national services, and then they say the public sector is choked and there are no opportunities for them elsewhere to work. And so finally you see them trekking along the Sahara Desert and Mediterranean Sea to Europe for greener pastures. We saw what happened in Senegal. We saw the popular uprising of the youth in Senegal. Have you forgotten of the Arab Spring? What happened? So what is happening in Kenya is equally happening in many African countries. And many of the youth are patiently waiting. There's time for everything. I think this is the time African leaders should make it a major topic at the AU summit to discuss the effects and dangerous policies of the IMF and World Bank biting the citizens in Africa. We must look at it. If not, it will come to a time that the whole continent will be turned upside down because of foreign neocolonial policies, which are not too different from the slavery activities.
France's complicity in Rwanda genocide.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Rwanda is this year commemorating the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide a period of around 100 days in which up to 1 million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu militias, while powerful countries, including France and the United States, stood by and refused to stop the mass killings. A study commissioned by Rwanda government states that France did nothing to prevent foreseeable April and May 1994 genocide. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame says lessons learned during the genocide are engraved in blood.
Our journey has been long and tough. Rwanda was completely humbled by the magnitude of our loss. And the lessons we learned are engraved in blood.
Various reports indicate that French government and military officials were involved in supplying weapons to the perpetrators of the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Additionally, evidence from official French archives revealed that during 1994 genocide in Rwanda, Paris allowed the perpetrators to flee and many went into hiding in France. The direct involvement of France in the Rwanda genocide is seen as a continuation of its neo-colonial meddling in Rwanda and other African countries.
The involvement of France in the unfortunate Rwanda genocide is likely driven by a combination of geopolitical factors as well as strategic interests. At that time, France, tried to maintain its influence in the region, especially in Africa, particularly in the concept of trying to stay closely with its former colonies. Although Rwanda was not a colony of France, it was really close to other colonies of France, like regional countries, DRC, and all that that had. A lot of, that had links to Rwanda. So the concept of Francafrique was still active, and so it tried to keep ties with its former colonies, and therefore it tried as much as it could to influence political decisions and directions, in those colonies. And that was where Rwanda came into picture. So it was more self-serving, that it was influencing the genocide in Rwanda, hoping that it would be in its own favor, in its own diplomatic interest.
For the majority of the early modern period, most Christian churches, both Catholic and Protestant, supported slavery and colonialism in Africa. That did not end there. The Catholic Church was accused of being close to the Hutu-led government in 1994 when nearly a million people were killed in 100 days. However, it was only in 2017 that Pope Francis, upon meeting the Rwandan President Paul Kagame, officially asked for forgiveness for the Catholic Church's role in the 1994 genocide. During the 20th anniversary commemorations in April 2014, Kagame accused the Catholic Church of having participated fully in establishing the colonial ideology that created the divide between Hutus and Tutsis, which he claimed led to the genocide. It took many years for the Catholic Church to eventually apologize for its role in the Rwanda genocide.
First, we must understand that the Church is a complex entity. It's a complex institution. While the Church itself is supposed to provide succor, a place of hope and peace and growth for people, sometimes humans have manipulated the Church and used it for really despicable things. So it is the nature of the Church, the Catholic Church especially, to take its time, considerable time, to go through a process of acknowledging the wrong and then accepted to apologize. We've seen that with the cases that the popes had to apologize with children that were violated by fathers in the church, and they had to open up inquiries and fact check what people were saying, and then at some point accepting that yes, this did happen, and therefore they need to apologize for all that happened. So that is one. Secondly, the reluctance for the church to
to apologize is because of the moral burden that hangs on, you know, on those who were involved. Because, yes, the church should ordinarily offer some sort of protection. At the point where it couldn't do that, it must acknowledge that and seek for, you know, forgiveness from all those involved.
After the genocide in Rwanda, Western powers claimed that never again will the world witness a genocide. 30 years later, the world is witnessing a live Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Just like in Rwanda, Western powers, led by the U.S., are directly involved in this unprecedented genocide that particularly targets Palestinian women and children. Clearly, the world did not learn from the Rwanda genocide.
The assumption that the world has not learned from the Rwandan genocide is a poignant reflection and reminder that indeed the world has failed again. Humanity has failed once more. Watching that, murderous onslaught on hapless civilians is going on in Gaza, and it is being beamed on the screens across the world. And then you have the UN, you have other, you know, international bodies paying lip service to the claim that genocide will not happen again, that, that you know, they need, there's a need for peace in the world, and they watch the mass murder and slaughter of hapless citizens, of hapless civilians, of women, of children, destruction and decimation of schools, you know, decimation of markets, you know, poisoning of water supply, you know, destruction of access to food aid, you know, of people who are defenseless. So, I mean, most of the time it is just lip service. And that is what we can see, because how is Rwanda any better than Palestine or Gaza, as the case may be? But people who feel that that might is right have continued to be on the side of Israel. However, most of the world have clearly stated their support for Palestine. Support in itself, lip support, does not count when you cannot officially stop and condemn the actions of, you know, the apartheid state of Israel and its actions against, hapless civilians in Gaza.
30 decades after the Rwanda genocide, neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo is said to be undergoing what is being termed as a slow genocide. The people of Congo have been holding countless protests demanding an end to the massacre of civilians.
As Congolese citizens, we have said no. It is not possible for our fellow citizens to continue to be massacred in the Rutshuru territory. We say no to this ignoble act perpetrated by the M23 in Kishishe, and we say no to the silence of the international community.
The government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo says the country's civilians are killed by militias, particularly the M23 rebel group backed by Rwanda, a country that is itself a victim of genocide. The authorities in Rwanda have rejected these allegations. These killings are taking place in the mineral-rich eastern part of Congo, neighboring Rwanda.
What we have is that we have the M23, who are actively operating in DRC, said to be supported by Rwanda. But Rwanda has consistently denied that it had any link with the M23. Unfortunately, the civilians are being hit, targeted. The military is losing a lot of, a lot of its infrastructure to the control of the M23 rebels. What we also know is that the activities of neighboring countries like Uganda, Rwanda, is affecting the DRC. Militia groups, over 100 militia groups, are expressing their grievances, unhealed, grievances. And until there's a truth commission to call all parties involved to the table to address these concerns, it may continue. And what we keep hearing are several forms of violations. You have rape, rhetoric and massacres, sexual violations, forced displacement, desecration of farmlands by these forces, and it's continually affecting the lives of residents in DR Congo. International community will continue to play lip service, because what you hear today is today MONUSCO, has been deployed as a United Nations peacekeeping mission. You have